Kiefer J. Mitchell Jr. joins us on the Center Maryland podcast, The Lobby. You know Kiefer. He was our first ever guest on The Lobby, gracious as the top chief legislative officer to the governor of the state of Maryland, the dreamiest job in all of American politics.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But Kiefer's now, you know, at one of the biggest, most meaningful lobbying enterprises in America. It's called BGR Group, and he's a vice president there leading their state and local efforts. And I've had a chance to intersect with him outside of Baltimore and Maryland and have seen him representing his clients most ably in Colorado and California. So welcome, Kiefer. Thanks for coming on the show.
How's it going, my friend? It's great to see you, and thanks for having me on.
Good, good. What's it like now that you've hopped over into the private sector? You know, you've always had a very public elected official sort of profile, working for the governor even after you retired from politics, so to speak. So what's it like being sort of in the, you know, sort of totally in the private sector?
You know, that's a great point. It is very different. You know, I got elected to the Baltimore City Council when I was 28 years old, 55 years old. So being in public service for that long of a time, and then now being here at BGR Group for just a little over a year and 2 months or so, it is definitely differences night and day. You know, private sector definitely has its benefits. You get that work-life balance. But, you know, in public sector, you know, especially elected office, you know, folks say, well, the legislature only works 90 days out of a year. That's not the case. You're at community meetings. You're taking constituent calls. You're either in your district office or, you know, constituents are pulling you up at the gas station or the grocery store with some issues. And you're always constantly on the go for the
always on, right? That's a different kind of stress, you know?
It is. And, you know, when I always tell people, when I first came into politics in the city council, there was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There were no cell phones, really, or, you know, the iPhones or anything. There were no video cameras recording.
Yeah, but there was that crazy lady at the, you know, at the Lexington Market or something,
right?
You know.
Right, exactly. They just had bullhorns out front City Hall. When you walked out the one door that you could walk out the front door, they start yelling at you. That was the only thing. Now everything is thrown on the internet and things like that. But in the private sector, you know, the approach I've taken is work as passionately for my clients as much as I did for citizens in my district. And you're sort of always on. You've got a client that calls you at 9 o'clock at night. You got to get back to them.
Right.
And you got to talk to them. You got to communicate. And it's similar a little bit about like in politics, you got to be proactive communicating. You know, you can't just wait till something happens. You got to reach out to folks to say, hey, this is coming down the pipe.
Do you struggle with like the advice versus acting? Like I recall coming out of government and I felt like I wasn't giving clients value by just giving them advice, that I had to like have some campaign or some sort of deliverable.
Right.
On the government affairs side, do you all feel that pressure? Or
yeah, there's pressure. You, like I said, you want to be proactive in your communication. You know, you don't want to just send your client a New York Times article on something and say, hey, thought you'd be interested in this. No, you want to be able to do a little deeper dive to say, you know, hey, this article came out, it's talking about, you know electric vehicles and infrastructure, and there's all this money, so we ought to think about, you know, XYZ, whether or not we should go after that money or come up with a strategy in these certain states to go after some of those inflation reduction dollars, those types of things. So you got to be a lot more proactive. and a lot more strategic. And, you know, you got to be seen sort of as a thought leader. That's what your clients are paying you for. One of the things I'm surprised about is the number of, you know, C-suite executives and those who really don't have a full understanding of how government operates or what the process is. And so, as someone that was in the city council and legislature and in the governor's office, I think I bring a unique value in terms of, like, here's how things operate. Here's how a legislator is going to hear things if you go and talk to them. Here's how the governor's office is going to operate when you go and talk to them. And you got to be a lot more strategic in your communication with them and what you discuss. You know, get your ask out first. You know, you do all the preliminary introductions, say, hey, we're here to talk about X, Y, and Z, and we need X, Y, and Z, and here's why. It tends to be a lot more effective. And, you know, I've had times where I've talked to clients and say, I wouldn't lead off with that, and here's why. And they get it. You know, they trust you. You know, that's why they hire you, me, and others in your firm to do the government relations piece.
BGR Group. Like, I know that as like Haley Barbour.
Correct. Haley Barbour is a founder over 30 years ago. Started off strictly as a Republican lobbying firm, and now it's a bipartisan lobbying firm. We are a multi-state lobbying group. We're not a law firm. We have offices in we have an office in Washington, D.C., Austin, Texas, and London. It's about 45 to 46 lobbyists over different practice areas. We have an international team that does international government relations. We have a PR practice, and then we have other practices broken up into various categories, a lot of it congressional and federal. So we have like an appropriations practice that deals strictly with, you know, federal funding and appropriations for clients. We have a defense practice dealing with the Pentagon and contracts and things like that. We have a financial services practice that deals with banking and banking issues. You know, this past spring with the banking crisis taking place, that was a very busy time for the firm and my colleagues on that side. And as you mentioned, I'm on the state and local side. There's about five of us on the team, and we handle everything from governors, attorney generals. We work with the U.S. Conference of Mayors and local governments, and we're getting into a lot of the attorney general's work on the attorney general side. So, you know, we take, like I said, a multi-state approach in terms of lobbying. There's not one issue that I'm sort of pigeonholed in. It's more of a general practice, and which I like, because you get to learn about the different issues as you go around. And but at the end of the day, the process is still the same from one state government to another state government. You just know, you know, the terminology and sort of how to operate.
You going down there to Washington, D.C. from Baltimore with your chip on your shoulder down there, or are you?
No,
like,
you know, it's funny. Like, I take the train. I take the MARC train in the mornings down to Washington, and I take the Metro.
But I know you're wearing like your Oriole hat, just kind
oh,
of.
Oh yeah, I always got to represent
the train station. You know,
that's right. My office, I got my Orioles jersey hanging in there. Football season, I have my Ravens Lamar Jackson jersey hanging in the background, so when we do Zoom calls, you know, they see, hey, this guy's from Baltimore.
Have you ever seen anybody do the Baltimore Washington thing better than Governor Westmore? He was like he was like running post routes for the Ravens like 1 week, and then the next week, you know, he's like shuffling down with the Redskins. You know, I was
exactly.
Like, this guy's good, man.
Yeah, you got to work. You got to, you know, with both stadiums and teams in Maryland, you got to play both sides, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we deserve a few. Our governor deserves to be anywhere in those stadiums he wants to be after that $600 million deal.
Exactly.
I guess you were on the front end of that, right? You guys worked on that.
Yeah, so when I was in Governor Hogan's office, we were working on that with the Camden Yards deal and then also in Prince George's County with FedEx Field and the Blue Line Corridor. That sort of thing in terms of transportation project, working with Angela, also Brooks, you know, county executive, also Brooks's office, Ben Barnes.
She's a star, isn't she?
She is. She's running a very hard election campaign for Senate. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, is this finally the year we see an African-American woman in the Senate?
Yeah, it looks like people all around the country are taking note of her.
Yeah,
candidacy.
If you think about it, what is it? It was only Carolyn Mosley Braun.
That's right.
Kamala Harris. And now Angela Alsobrook has the opportunity.
Wow.
Yeah.
David Trone is going to spend
a lot of money. You know, yeah, I live in Baltimore City. I think at one point we were getting like two or three mailers. Within a week or so, just on base David Trone.
He had the president come out to his district, you know, in the last go round in Western Maryland. I mean, he's a formidable dude.
He's formidable, but you know, I know the cliche is like, yeah, you got all the money, but it's going to be organization. And
I don't know. To me, you know what it feels like? The closest thing I can equate it to. Because, you know, it could have kind of set up like if you Mike Davis from Venable would always talk about sort of the racial dynamic in Maryland politics. But if you look at those Senate races, Van Hollen versus Edwards, Cardin versus Mfume. I mean,
yeah,
man, that was tight. And
it was tight.
Didn't have that much money, you know. But still, the white candidate, they all have many more characteristics, obviously, than that. But you know,
right.
You got a white U.S. senator, you know, you can't ignore that history. I just feel like this dynamic is, it feels to me like marriage equality. It's like, if you want to be cool in Democratic politics,
right,
you better get with Angela also.
Yeah, you gotta be
like, why wouldn't you be on this one? You know, it's that's kind of vibe I get. That's formidable.
And she's doing a great job, getting a lot of the establishment folks. She got the, you know, Senator Van Hollen, who's now going to be the senior senator from Maryland, to come out and endorse her last week. She got Johnny Osesky and Kwasi Mfume and, you know, all others to come out and endorse her. So she's really harnessing the establishment and congressional folks like that. I think I just saw in the paper that, you know, Congressman Trone is getting like the Adam Schiff's of the world and others to endorse him based on his work in Congress.
Right.
At the end of the day, as you know, in Maryland politics, it's about organization on the ground. It's not just television ads, get your name out there, but it's, you know, this whole different dynamic of mail-in voting, early voting.
Right, right. It's a real staged process that you got to communicate around and organize around.
Right, and you got to count your voters who are going to the polls, matching those, you know, walk lists with, did they early vote or did they mail-in
vote?
You know, it's not the days where you can hire a bunch of school buses and say, all right, let's go to the senior home and round folks up to go to the polling place. You know,
I miss those days.
Those are the best days right there. With the bull.
I was so incompetent. They were like, you don't even let that guy deliver the food. Yeah, that's when you find yourself in communications, Kiefer, is when you know we're the most worthless members of the whole political unit.
Exactly.
Right?
I think the last election I worked a polling place here in the city and no one was there. I was like, what happened? What's going on? It's like, well, we already voted. I was like, oh, all right.
Man.
Very quiet.
I would dress the polls in the morning as kind of a tradition. I get to do that with like Peter O'Malley. That was a real treat, you know. But I remember doing it with Martin Knott for the Anthony Brown versus Larry Hogan race. And we were out in like northern Baltimore County, man. And it was just like, and that, I mean, I say northern, from Timonium up, you know.
Oh, Timonium up, yeah, that was
and,
all.
But man, you know, it's all, that's sort of Bob Ehrlich country there. But still, I just was like, man, I don't see anybody coming.
You're right.
I was like, oh, better get my plane ticket to Colorado. Listen, you're you know, the state and local chief over there. You got a couple partners in that respect working with you. When you walk around Washington, D.C., Clarence Maurice Mitchell Jr.
Yeah.
Is that
it's a sense of pride. You know, I remember, you know, you're referring to
just
my
for people that, yeah, people that don't, your grandfather.
He was known as the 101st Senator. He was the director of the NAACP Washington Bureau, which was sort of like the public policy legislative arm of the NAACP. And he was there from the 1950s, retired in 1978, I believe. But, you know, he was the one working the halls of Congress of every major piece of civil rights legislation. 50s, going back to the 57 Civil Rights Act, 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, fair housing laws, those types of things. He was there. But as a kid, going to visit him in his office, which was on Massachusetts Avenue by Union Station, you know, and I get off the train, sometimes I walk to work, which is downtown. I pass by where his office was, and it's a great memory. And, you know, the neat thing about it was he was doing all these important things, but he was still a grandfather. He always took time with us in terms of his work. I remember I was on a school trip. We went to, you know, I was in elementary school, and we went down to the National Zoo on Connecticut Avenue. And, you know, we unload on the bus and everything. And who was there parked just behind the bus, standing outside the doors of the bus, was my grandfather, dressed up in a suit. And he was always very dignified, suit and tie. And came by to say hello and welcome and said, hello, you're in D.C. And I think the coolest part, I didn't get to ride the bus back. You know, he came back to pick me up and took me to his office. That was nice. Pretty cool.
Very cool. That.
I had no idea what he was working on, but this was in the 70s and all. And, you know, he was always doing busy work. But, you know, I go down there and I think about him. I also think about my Uncle Perrin, who served in Congress, representing the 7th District of Maryland.
The OG.
Yeah. So when I go to, you know, the Rayburn Burke building where his office was, and he's also, his first office was in the Cannon House office building, you know, when I have meetings, I think of them, and they're definitely missed, but they establish, you know, it's their shoulders that I stand on as I walk around Washington and do my work in terms of government relations and things like that.
Something special about your grandfather being the chief lobbyist, chief legislative officer to
exactly
right to the NAACP, calling the 101st senator, man, that is not like nothing else.
But right, and a lot of people don't realize this. My grandfather, he was a registered independent. A lot of people think, oh, the Mitchells are all Democrats and all, and we were registered Democrats and Democrat and all that. But my grandfather purposely was a registered independent, because representing the NAACP, he had to work with both sides of the aisle. And so when he went into the office, that's how he was able to get the name, the nickname 101st Senator, because, you know, Republicans and Democrats had a tremendous amount of respect for him on Capitol Hill, because he never wore his politics on his sleeve. He was a registered independent, so he could actually credibly tell folks, I'm an independent, I'm not a partisan person. And unfortunately, you don't have that stuff these days. But, you know, when you go into, you know, he always used to tell a story, you know, he'd have to go into a Mississippi congressman's office and they would curse and yell at him and all the time, but they still met with him. You know, they still heard him out and everything like that. And it was it's a great history about that era of politics.
And then you were the chief legislative officer for one of the most popular governors in America, Larry Hogan. And then I saw you guys recently, like you guys must have had a lunch date or something. I saw something online where you
guys. Yeah, it was funny. So I started off with Governor Hogan's office after I left the legislature. He reached out and asked me to, he was looking to form a bipartisan staff, bipartisan, you know, administration, still a Democrat. And I ended up working in his legislative officer, becoming his chief legislative officer, helping to shepherd his legislative agenda around. And it was a challenge, but I was there 7.5 years. He's term limited, so I had to find a real job. But
that's the realest job in Maryland politics.
That's right. And the difference was I needed to pay for 2 college tuitions.
That's fair.
There
enough.
You go.
Sold.
So, you know, there you go.
I always have dreams about those jobs until I think about that part. Yeah.
But we reached out and we had lunch, and he had just started driving again. For 8 years, he didn't drive because he had trooper protection.
That's what it was. That's right.
And that's he said, "Hey, I'm going to drive." And I said, "You know, Governor, all due respect, why don't we walk? You know, it's been a while." So it was sort of a surreal experience. Normally, you know this from working in politics, you know, this executive protection team, governor walks out the door, he gets in a car, car's right there. Here I am with former Governor Hogan, and we're looking for, he's like taking his little alert on his car, like, where's my car parked? Let me find out.
It's a different vibe, right?
It's a much different vibe.
Well, what do you think is the takeaway from this? I don't know if it's a third party effort. What is it? This no labels effort?
Yeah,
is Hogan taking a real look at that?
Yeah, he's one of the founders. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in a while, so I don't know what his thinking is. I know that there's a lot of folks that are interested in him running. I heard we heard it all the time when he was currently the governor, run for president, running in the Republican Party. One of the things that a lot of people admire about Governor Hogan is his ability to just tell it like it is and his forthrightness. And he was forthright about the current state of politics, particularly in the Republican Party. And you got to remember, you know, his dad was a congressman and did Larry Hogan Sr. and did a very, very unpopular thing at the time within the Republican Party. He voted on that Judiciary Committee for the articles of impeachment on Richard Nixon. And he was the only Republican that did that. And, you know, a lot can be said that they thought because of his vote that he lost his chance to run for governor back then. And he took a very courageous stand with the, you know, paraphrasing Larry Hogan Sr., that no person is above the law and above the Constitution of the United States. And so, you know, Governor Hogan gets it from his, you know, it's in his DNA to speak out. And so when he started going after former President Trump and still talking about the direction of the Republican Party, he means it. It's just not, you know, words and just looking to get on TV and using talking points. He means it.
When you looked at that stage on the Republican primary, like,
it was tough. I switched back to the Oriole game.
Vivek Ramaswamy seems to have come on the scene in the polling in early states and then at the debate. So does that, if you're Larry Hogan and you're looking at that, are you like, that confirms the fact that there's not a lane there if that guy's getting contraction, or does it say to him, you know, this guy can get traction, maybe I should have been in that? You think there's
I from knowing the governor, I think he's just shaking his head. I think knowing him, that he's embarrassed by the direction of where the party has gone, and you know, the type of talk and rhetoric that was being displayed up there. Now, he's very close with Chris Christie, former governor of New Jersey. And he has also
now,
very
look,
good relationship.
You know, Kiefer, you know Chris Christie is a former University of Delaware student body president, like your
blue
host
hen.
Here. Like your host.
That's right.
We have the same exact collegiate advisor from the University of Delaware. And I'm like, that lady was Dr. Marilyn Prime was a most patient soul.
See, there you go. Well, I went to
anyway. Yeah, so that would be kind of his lane, right? Christie, maybe
that would be his lane, and he also has a very good relationship with Mike Pence. You know,
that's true.
You know, Mike Glenn Pence.
I thought he had kind of the biggest wake up performance. Kind of like, don't forget about me.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, he started getting his voice. Now, the criticism of Mike Pence is, well, he should have come out a lot stronger and earlier on that whole January 6th stuff, going after President Trump and his actions. You know, the man's life was threatened because of some actions on President Trump. So, you know, I think Governor Hogan is a little embarrassed about where the direction of the Republican Party is in terms of the hold that, you know, that, let, you know, the most telling part, which was to me as a citizen, was the embarrassment. The question was, would you support a person like President Trump, even if he was convicted of the crimes? And they raised their hands. You know, I was just like, what party is this, and what has happened? I think I haven't talked to the governor.
Yeah, they were very adept at switching the conversation to, like, they went right to, like, a politically motivated prosecution and started talking about blowing up the Justice Department. Like, they didn't even acknowledge, like.
And that just shows where the base is. And
same on abortion. They were very adept at just being like, I'm totally not going to acknowledge anything the Supreme Court did. And I'm going to talk about late term abortion. Like,
right. And I thought Nikki Haley and Doug Burgum of North Dakota had a good answer on the national, on terms of a federal ban on abortion, say, you know, make an argument of states' rights. You know, leave it to the states. And I was
that was his best answer.
Yeah. And so you just see where this party is. It's, you know, it's going to take some time.
After I saw that Kristi Noem commercial, I was wondering why she wasn't up there.
I missed it. I missed that. I think I
checked that one out. I think turning out the lights at the state house, it might come back to bite her a little bit, but you know, I'm sure everybody in that state wouldn't mind the state house having its lights off.
I think what was evident of that debate was all the folks, particularly you mentioned
Vivek Ramaswamy. Vivek,
you know, they're all auditioning for vice president. You know, that's what I got a sense of, that they're all auditioning to be the vice president for Trump or in the cabinet. You know, the interesting part is, like, President Obama won election. All the folks in that primary, in his first primary in 2008, served in his cabinet.
That's right.
So
that's right. Well said.
You know, so you look at those debates as a, you know, business development opportunities.
Exactly. Hey, speaking of job opportunities, you know, one thing I had thought, and you can dissuade me of this, but, you know, I always thought one of the better slogans in politics was the Democratic Governors Association, when they made it like jobs opportunity now. Like, now I think they still have that up there when you come out to Aspen. I think they're still going to have jobs opportunity now. Mm-hmm. And then I hear a lot of Democratic messaging on jobs. I see a talk about Bidenomics, but that, you know, I just feel like our jobs, is that everybody's top priority? Like, it, you know, the economy does. Could we be a victim of our own success in that? Yeah. Any thoughts about, like, do we over talk about jobs just because it's like, it's such a reflexive priority to talk about? I wonder if we're not getting, like, Like when I spoke at Goucher, and all the students cared about was work-life balance and remote work and all this. Like, so I just wondered if jobs is and the economy's kind of booming right now. Is that the message? Any thoughts? Sorry.
That's a great point. I think it depends on what kind of jobs. You know, the Democratic Party traditionally has gone after the blue collar worker, you know, jobs, the factory jobs, the manufacturing jobs, jobs that have been shipped overseas, and always preaching, hey, we're going to bring those jobs back. But the reality is we're in a global economy. And so now you just got to, I think it's still jobs, but I think you have to broaden the surface a little bit in terms of the types of jobs, tech jobs.
But don't do me like the classic technocrat Democrat who's like,
right,
who's like, they just go solar jobs,
biopharma
jobs, you know, like it's like,
right,
just these kind of jobs are okay.
Yeah, but you got to calibrate to what the economy is dictating in terms of jobs, workforce development, and skills training.
Yeah.
You know, when you and I were coming up in politics, and you and I going to college, you know, I'm sure you didn't have an option to take a year off, say, hey, you know, Mom, Dad, I'm going to take some time off and see if I want to find myself. No, you were going to college right after high school. Nowadays, you know, can you afford college? And hey, well, I'm learning a skill. And so you're starting to see these workforce development jobs, training taking place in a high school level, grabbing kids as early as middle school to get them interested in certain jobs. And so, you know, college can be an option, but it doesn't need to be the only option with some of the skills-based training and jobs that are out there. But you also brought up another point about another generation where I think the pandemic really exposed, like, do you need to be in an office all the time to work? Why can't you, with technology, why can't we do a Zoom call like we're doing now? Why can't I work from home and have a better work-life balance? I think you're going to see that a lot. Now, I come from a generation where I need to be in the office. You know, if I'm home working, I'm watching ESPN, eating snacks, mixing lunches, drinking beer, that sort of thing.
Said the guy who dedicated his whole life to the community. You know,
exactly.
Don't believe a word he's saying. I bet you never got to sit on your couch. You were always out there dealing with one issue or another. No exactly. Escape being a city councilman of Baltimore, man.
Exactly.
No escape. Hey, Kiefer, any trends? I'll let you go. But any trends or thoughts you know, you had such a Baltimore and then Maryland focused life and lifestyle. Now you get to relate those experiences to, you know, U.S. Conference of Mayors or governors all over the country. We're going to see you out at the Democratic governors in Aspen, Colorado. So any trends that you see or feel out there that you could lead us on to?
Yeah. So in terms of issues, you know, you're seeing a lot, you know, you're seeing some interesting trends, and they're happening in blue states and red states. You know, the thing I enjoy about working with BGR, we're bipartisan and we work in red and blue states. So I'm able to see all different sides, whether you're in Austin, Texas, at the capital there, or you're in Salt Lake City, or whether you're in Springfield, Illinois. One of the things that you are seeing are the role the attorney generals are playing, particularly along, you know, ESG issues, you know, in terms of the red states, particularly as it relates to fossil fuels. If you are a company that says, hey, you know, we got an ESG model here and we're going to start taking a hard look at or divesting from, you know, fossil fuels, what does that do in Texas and Louisiana? Attorney generals come right back and say, well, we're going to make sure you're not part of our pension system or anything like that. So we're going to divest out of you guys. And so you're seeing a lot of ESG issues, not just on, you know, the social side, but also the economics side and the governance side. And the other thing is looking at how artificial intelligence is playing out, particularly at the mayor's level, you know, where, you know, this, Damien, from days in the city, you know, the length it takes to get a permit to build a garage or to build a fence in your backyard, you know, where you can cut that down and you're starting to see artificial intelligence sort of move into local government to do back office type work, like zoning permits or building permits, that sort of thing. So a lot of it having to deal with technology you're seeing out there, cybersecurity is another issue. And then at the state legislative level, you're looking at a lot of privacy laws, particularly how we protect our children through TikTok and all the social media things. Those are trends that you're starting to see take place throughout the country, not just in Maryland, but all over.
Kiefer J. Mitchell.
Junior? Mr. Damien O'Darby.
You're a junior?
Junior. Exactly.
I remember the old man well.
That's right. Doc Mitchell. He told it like it is. He was one of the great doctors. He was a gastroenterologist. He passed away in 2015, but he was so old school. He would sit there in his office. If you were his patient, Damien, he'd sit across his desk, read your chart, telling, hey, you got to, you know, lose some weight, Damien. You got to stop smoking so much. And he'd be puffing away on a Marlboro cigarette. And then you would say as his patient, well, what about you, doctor? He goes, don't you worry about me. I'm worrying about you. That's why I pay. But definitely an old school doctor, and was just a great human being, a great dad. Think about him every day. But
super kind. I remember having dinner with him down in Harbor East one time. I remember him. He always very well dressed, even if he didn't need to be.
Exactly.
Right.
He always wore, he's like my grandfather, wore a shirt and tie or a collared shirt, and always had a jacket on. It was always interesting the way, I don't think I ever saw him in shorts or anything.
Right. What a special man. Well, thank you for sharing him with us. Thank you for sharing your whole family with us, the legacy. And
it's great to see you. Great to be here. And, you know, you and I go a long way back, even though you're a St. Joe guy, a Boys Latin guy, but, you know, we won't hold that against you. But
neither of us are lacrosse stars.
No, none of us were. No, not at all.
All right, Kiefer. Thank you, my man. I appreciate it.
See you. Thanks. See you, bro.
Thank you.